Today in Studio 360, 25 years ago, he made his film debut in a horror movie called Clown House. And this year,
Maddie,
he starred in a remake of Poltergeist. So what scares Sam Rockwell?
There's kind of a dread with doing theater. You love the play, but you know you've got to go do this, and there's this gorilla on your back all day.
The stage actor turned Hollywood actor Sam Rockwell is back on stage on Broadway. And then, if a lot of today's pop songs sound the same to you, that's because they're all written by the same few people. And those people are mainly Swedes.
They tend to listen more to the syllables and how they match up with the sounds and care less about what the line means.
All that and much more is ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
And I'll write your name.
But to start the show, whenever I hear that Sam Rockwell is in a movie, I am automatically excited to see it. This has been going on for 13 years now, ever since he starred in Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
I call it the dating game. A pretty girl asks three handsome guys, who she can't see, silly questions, and based on their answers, she picks one to date, and we pay for the date. That's it. That's the show.
I loved his portrayal of Chuck Barris, the pathetic, funny, sleazy, real-life TV game show creator and host. Sam Rockwell seems to revel in playing the deranged and amusingly demented, and doing so with a singular intensity and believability. This fall, he brings that to Broadway in a revival of Sam Shepard's Fool for Love. He plays a rodeo cowboy who drives 2,480 miles, tequila bottle and lasso in hand, to track down his lover in a motel room somewhere in the Southern California nether regions. He and the whole production have gotten absolutely rave reviews and totally deserve them. Sam Rockwell joins me now, as far as I can tell, with neither tequila nor lasso. But I'm glad he's here. Welcome.
Thank you, Kurt, for that fantastic introduction. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
I reuse it anytime. We can play it as you walk through the street.
Thanks.
In an interview in the Paris Review once, Shepard described this play as, quote, a quasi-realistic melodrama, kind of dissing it. I'd never seen it produced before, and this production didn't strike me as so melodramatic. I was expecting, oh, this is going to be this savage, dark, serious piece. And it plays as a comedy a lot. And so, which got me wondering, you're more familiar with the play and have been for years. Was the humor always there, or 30 years later, are we more able to laugh at that kind of perversity and tragedy?
You know? Probably. You know, there are a lot of laughs in it, and he's put in a few other little funny lines.
Oh, there are new lines in it?
There's a couple of new lines.
Huh.
Just little words like goats. Sam really loves the laughs. I love the laughs too. I think it's a sneak attack, and I think it's a nice way to kind of grab the audience. And it's a very poignant, beautiful play.
Yes.
You know, about intimacy. And, you know,
I want to play a clip. This is from close to the beginning of the show.
I'm going.
Don't go.
What am I gonna do? Huh? What am I supposed to do?
Oh, you know.
What?
You're gonna erase me.
What are you talking about?
You're either going to erase me or you're going to have me erased.
Why would I want that? Are you kidding me?
Because I'm in the way.
Don't be stupid.
Hey, I am smarter than you are, and you know it. I can smell your thoughts before you even think them.
May, I'm trying to take care of you, all right?
No, you're not. You're just guilty. You're gutless and guilty.
Good combination.
That's you as Eddie and the amazing Nina Arianda as May. This play is less than an hour and a half long. You two are pretty much on stage the entire time, going back and forth pretty much like that.
Yeah.
It looks exhausting.
It's pretty exhausting. As soon as you wake up, you're thinking about it.
Really? Yeah.
You love the play, but you know you've got to go do this, and there's this gorilla on your back all day, and you're kind of thinking.
So 4.5 hours, the countdown has already begun in your head?
Yeah, you know. You're already thinking like, okay, I got to go warm up.
And is that totally different than doing a movie where you just know your lines, you go do them, and it's kind of the emotionally level experience?
Doing a movie is a much more tedious process. You know, it's bit by bit. and it's longer hours, but this is condensed, you know, melodrama, I guess you could say, or whatever.
Yeah.
You got one shot. You know, there's no intermission. You got one shot to kind of do this, and it says this play should be done relentlessly without a break.
Yeah.
It's really the best training for an actor because of the fact that it's nonstop. There's not really a break. I always say to young actors, you know, you have to do theater because it's like a gymnasium. You're not going to work those muscles in film, you know, as much.
Right.
I mean, you can do a lead in a film and it's very strenuous, but it's not, this is really like you're up there and you're naked and it's
right.
happening.
Yeah,
and
as opposed to the slow motion marathon of making a movie.
Yeah, so. You know, and if you missed with the lasso you drop a line, you got to keep going.
You're really good with the lasso.
Hey, thanks. Thanks a lot. I've been practicing for like a year.
I can imagine. I read several places where you've said that you like playing blue collar characters.
Yeah.
Whom this rodeo cowboy you're playing now is. But you grew up in this, what sounds like a kind of artsy milieu in New York and San Francisco. So how did working class become this thing you feel comfortable doing?
I think it was kind of a semi-bohemian working class upbringing. My dad drove a cab. He worked at the post office. He was a union organizer. He was a printer. He was an actor. So we kind of moved around a lot. We lived in the Tenderloin in San Francisco. But I would visit my mother in the summer. And she was singing telegrams for a living
in New York,
and she was doing these little plays off Broadway, and I ended up being in a play with her, and that's how I got in. But there was that in the summer, there was this sort of bohemian existence, hanging out with adults in New York, and then I'd go back to San Francisco when my dad got remarried and got a good job. But before that, it was a little bit like me and my dad were.
Footloose.
Yeah, we were, he was struggling
and
I was, he was a single parent
and so
everything was ground beef and a glass of milk and, you know, add powder, you know?
Yes.
So, he gave up his acting career to raise me and stuff like that. And
so your mother, through your mother, you started acting.
Yeah.
And then acted, but I read didn't study it until you were 24 years old.
That was when I started to take it seriously. I was in sort of a performing arts school in San Francisco. I took it sort of for granted. And then I studied with William Esper 2 years of the Meisner technique. When I started training with Bill, I realized, this is a craft, and this is something you have to take seriously.
Well, and from what I know about the Meisner technique, it's very much about the craft. So you once said, apropos all this, to play drunk, you don't get drunk. You go to a bar and order a Coke and watch drunks.
Yeah, exactly.
Which,
yes, you do. Yes, you do. I have gotten drunk and videotaped it.
Just to see what it was like?
Yeah, I did that for Confessions. And so we read scenes from Confessions, and my friend Ivan was there. My dad actually filmed it, and, you know, I got hammered.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting to watch afterwards. It was a good behavior.
You were able to imitate yourself?
Yeah, but I wouldn't recommend that to young actors. I think it's a dangerous
–
I was young, and my body could handle it, but, you know, I couldn't do that now.
So as – not to caricature these different styles, but, like, as a Meisner actor, if you're suddenly in a scene with – you know, Daniel Day-Lewis or Christian Bale, is it problematic?
No. You mean because there's...
Because there's some method in channeling the character and all that.
No, I don't think so. I think good acting is good acting. And I think...
However you get there.
Listen, if you're playing a heroin addict, you can't take heroin. If you're going to...
Kill somebody.
If you're going to kill somebody or shoot yourself in a movie, what are you going to really shoot yourself? Or So, you know, there's limits. You know, you can do certain things. You can drive a cab if you're playing a cab driver or whatever. But, you know, there's limits.
Yeah. You've said that, and it seems to me patently true, that film is not really an actor's medium because the director is in charge making the choices. Is that frustrating because it's not really up to you how your performance gets shown to the audience?
Yeah, sure. Sometimes it is. I've been lucky. I think that's why I prefer to do leads, because if you're going to get a scene, if a scene's cut, you know, you're still in the f***ing movie, you know what I mean?
Yes,
but it's like, you're not, And you have a little more, you get more of a flow like you would on stage. Uh-huh. You know, it's hard to do acting in bursts.
Right. I want to go back a few years to one of my favorite movies of yours, Moon. Your character, Sam Bell, is stranded on the far side of the moon where he's been mining helium for what he thinks is a 3-year stint. He also thinks he's alone except for his AI entity, the computer Gertie.
Hey, Gertie, since I've been up here, I've sent Tess, I've sent her over 100 video messages. Where did those messages go? Did they ever reach her?
Sam, I can only account for what occurs on the base.
What about the messages she sent to me?
Sam, I can only account for what occurs on the base.
That's Sam Rockwell in the Duncan Jones film Moon. And listeners, spoiler alert, it turns out that Sam Bell is not alone and not even Sam Bell. He's a clone, one of several clones. So you are the only actor, effectively, in the film. Kevin Spacey's voice is there with you. That must have been an exceptional and singular experience, being in a film all by yourself. And, of course, it meant the director couldn't cut you out of the movie.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, was that a pleasant thing to do or a really hard thing to do?
It was very challenging. Duncan and I were not really sure if it was going to work until we did the first motion control shot. We had an amazing CGI guy, and he got the two clones to touch at one point, which is very difficult to do technically. And so,
and it's a really cheap movie.
It's a cheap movie.
$5 million, he told me, which astounded me.
33 days, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I wanted the clones to hug at one point, and I was trying to recreate a moment from Midnight Cowboy where Joe Buck sort of combs Ratso's hair. And I was watching that movie a lot because of the sort of sickness that Ratso has and the clones getting sick. And I watched Dead Ringers a lot because it was, that's the best I've seen that trick done. Uh-huh. Jeremy Irons and his DVD commentary was very helpful.
With his twin.
Yeah. That's the best I've ever seen that trick done. Huh. So I think that was really crucial.
So doing that in that movie, you pull it off. I mean, there's nothing there. As your
Well, you had a body double who's also he's an actor,
and
he's,
so your face is digitally put on him.
Yeah, he looks like me from the back. He's a young kid they got, and he'd read with me, and we'd switch parts, and it was a very technical but really creative process. It was mind boggling.
What's your next job?
My next job, I'm trying to figure that out. I think I'm going to do a movie with Martin McDonagh next year. And Frances McDormand, and possibly Woody Harrelson. So
that sounds great.
That could be cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good. I'll put that in my calendar for 2017. Sam Rockwell, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me.
You can see Sam Rockwell in Fool for Love on Broadway through December 13th. Coming up, John Seabrook takes me inside the pop music factory to explain how hits are perfectly manufactured and assembled these days.
The machine can make 30 tracks at once, get 30 different melody writers to listen to each one, send them out over the internet, and get 30 songs in the time that it would have taken to make one or two songs in the past.
That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
When I'm with you.
Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. When a new track by Taylor Swift or Katy Perry comes out, it is suddenly everywhere, instantly. But if the last couple of decades of pop music has started to blend together for you, sound even more formulaic, it might be because there is more of a formula than ever, which is what sent John Seabrook on his quest. He's a writer for The New Yorker, and he has just published The Song Machine, which is a fascinating behind-the-scenes investigation of how the biggest hits get made, a specific type of hit.
It's a pop song. It's a hit song. It's a song that is built around a central hook. And if it has more than one hook, then that's even better. It's not a progressive, flowing ballad. It's a hit you with a hook, and it's a bit of a high fructose song where, for ADD attention spans, where you need something really exciting to happen every 7 seconds.
In the early 20th century, pop music was churned out on Tin Pan Alley, and then in the 50s and 60s at the Brill Building. So songs written by professional songwriters, as opposed to the singers who sing them, is nothing new.
What is new is the way the songs are written and the way they're recorded. So instead of having a melody writer and a lyric writer sitting around a piano banging out a song and then having production added later, the production comes first. The reason it is that way is because you can make a lot more songs that way. The machine can make 30 tracks at once, get 30 different melody writers to listen to each one, send them out over the internet, and get 30 songs in the time that it would have taken to make one or two songs in the past. And maybe 28 of those songs is bad, but two of them might be really good. And the percentage of two out of 28 is worth doing it that way.
So we've gone from some sort of artisanal version in the workshop to a more truly industrialized version.
That's right. It's industrialized.
So the track, as you refer to it, is not, as we talk about tracks being the whole song, it's the underlying musical bed.
It's the bed. It's the chord progression and the beats, essentially.
And hooks, so the melody includes a hook, the hook being what?
The hook is a very short melodic phrase that comes usually right at the chorus, but if you can have one at the beginning and in halfway to the chorus, it's even better. And it distills the melodic essence of the song without actually giving you much of a melody. It's the essence of the melody.
So the songs of Taylor Swift have been ubiquitous, particularly ubiquitous lately. Her latest album, 1989, has a whole bunch of songs created by the operators of your machine. So let's play and deconstruct one of those so we can all understand how it's a product of this formula. This is the song Blank Space.
This is the blank space right here. This song has a lot of blank spaces in it, and it starts with one, and then that's going to come back after each choral turn. And it's the contrast between the blankness of the sound in those spaces and then the vocal melody that I think is the real essence of this song. So it's going to be forever, or it's going to go down in flames. You can tell me when it's over. With these songs, the verses are a little bit disposable. They're really just setting up the chorus. So this is the verse part, and now now it starts. And it wouldn't have started as dramatically if we didn't have that earlier kind of throwaway verse part. The other important thing about this is the way the lyrics are delivered with the melody. So the words are chopped up. She's singing in a, not in a flowing way, but in a way that the words, the syllables even, serve the beats. And it's as though the beats are leading the syllables. And I think that's quite a different vocal style than her earlier style, where it was much more of a flowing singing style. The third thing I'd say about it is everything is synthetic. Okay?
Right, right.
There are no instruments you're hearing right now.
Except her voice.
Whereas if you go back and listen to You Belong With Me, it's that Nashville sound. It's warm. It's guitars. It's strings. There's nothing recognizable among these sounds as to what made them, because they're all made on a computer.
Right. Now, and we're going to keep talking about how this system came to be, but to me, a lot of this kind of music seem indistinguishable. And your book reassured me that it's not just because I'm a clueless old dude. I mean, for instance, two big hit songs you mentioned that have fairly different hooks, but almost identical tracks. One is Beyoncé's Halo.
Remember those walls I built? Well, baby, they're tumbling down. And they didn't even put up a fight. They didn't even make the sound.
And then here is Kelly Clarkson's song, Already Gone.
Remember all the things we wanted? Now all our memories, they're haunted. We were always meant to say goodbye.
It's the same track.
It's a cover version.
No, it is the same track.
Or literally.
Literally. Ryan Tedder made the same track and sent it out to two different melody writers. Two different songs were written. Somebody screwed up and forgot. Something happened. Beyonce recorded Halo. Kelly Clarkson was about to come out with Already Gone when she heard Halo and said, this is the same song. I have to pull Already Gone off my album.
Uh-huh.
But it didn't get pulled off the album. And in fact, it became just as big a hit as Halo. So I guess the listeners either didn't notice or didn't care.
But and no litigation resulted in that case?
No. There was a lot of yelling and screaming.
Yeah. So talk about how and when and where this assembly line song production began.
Yeah, so much of this stuff comes from Sweden, and the reason it comes from Sweden is several reasons. One is that there was a very influential DJ in the late 80s and early 90s called Dennis Pop. That wasn't his real name. And he was very ambitious to make songs for the American market. And even though it was a rather outlandish idea that somebody from a foreign country would write the songs for American and British charts, several advantages worked for the Swedes. One was, I think because they don't come from this balkanized world of R&B and pop that we come from, where, you know, white people aren't supposed to be writing R&B songs. But the Swedes, they
sat
down. It's
just all English music.
They didn't care. Yeah, it's English music, and they didn't really even maybe notice they were writing R&B songs. And I think that is part of what they've done. They've been able to combine the rhythmic part of R&B with pop and really created a whole new kind of rhythmic pop through the success of their songs.
So, and they are an incredibly English fluent country. So that combined with not having the baggage of, oh, this is the ghetto of pop and the ghetto of R&B.
Right. And they also didn't have the baggage of all of our highfalutin English metaphors and double entendres and witticisms. They don't take English to that level.
Right.
And so they tend to listen more to the syllables and how they match up with the sounds and care less about what the line means. And even though that sounds limiting, in another way, it's freeing.
You know English, but not too well. It's like what the Dadaists did with made-up languages 100 years ago. But
you know what? That's right.
There's this one studio called Sharon, out of which these people came. The first giant hit that was written this way was a song called All That She Wants by the then unknown Swedish band, Ace of Base.
Ace of Base. Catching Tan on the Beach. This was sort of reggae, light reggae synth pop about catching tan, another Swedish neologism. Oh. And it became an enormous hit, and it put both Dennis Pop and Sweden on the map. And that's how they got the Backstreet Boys.
And their next hit, which was not just an Ace of Base ripoff, but this song that the Backstreet Boys did.
Yeah, that song kind of combines early 90s R&B grooves with a very synthy, Abbey-y, Dennis Poppy kind of song making. So now Max Martin, who started out actually as a glam rocker, has joined Sharon.
Also not his real name.
Yeah, also not his real name. All of them have aliases. And it has the 80s choruses, which are another huge element in today's pop.
So this guy, Max Martin, at what point did the American music industry decide, okay, this is the guy, this is the wizard, he has broken the code, like early 2000s?
Well, interestingly, in the early 2000s, there was a backlash against Max Martin. There was a so at the end of the 90s, there was this huge run-up of record sales with bands like Backstreet Boys, NSYNC, and Britney, all songs written by Swedes, in particular Max Martin. But then after 9/11, there was a real turn away from that stuff, a feeling that it was boring and too middle of the road. And Max Martin actually had trouble getting cuts on records for a couple of years there. And it wasn't until he teamed up with an American who called himself Dr. Luke, who had a much more sort of indie hip-hop background and made much edgier sounds as a producer, that he was able to reinvent himself and come back, and then had another huge run, starting with Kelly Clarkson, but going through Pink and then culminating in Katy Perry.
Well, and speaking of Kelly Clarkson, her first couple of albums are an interesting story in the context of your book, because she sort of switched gears.
Yeah, well, her first album was, clearly she was marketed as an Idol winner, and but Clive Davis, he took on Kelly Clarkson and decided that he really wanted to establish her as a recording artist and not as an American Idol winner. And for that, he needed to have professional songwriters doing top-level songs. She wanted to write her own songs. She saw herself as a singer-songwriter. Uh-huh. And he insisted that she put Max Martin's song, Since You've Been Gone, on her record. And it made her second album a huge success. But then for her third album, she did, in fact, write her own songs, much to Clive Davis's horror. And that album sold 1/10 of the previous album. So that just goes to show.
John Henry has lost to the steam engine.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great way of putting it, Kurt. It's true.
That song, Since You've Been Gone, the Kelly Clarkson song, is also an example of comping, which was, in this context, a term of art I didn't know. What is comping?
So comping is when you re-record the vocal over and over again. You have the singer sing just phrases at a time or even single words at a time over and over. So you can take 40 takes on one line and 40 takes on another line, and then out of those 40 takes, just take the very best take or even of half the line, and you get a vocal that is in no way sort of natural,
right,
but just absolutely pops out of the record.
So it really has become more of a science, more of an industry. People like Max Martin, these wizards of this new system, are they any more or less hacks or artists than their predecessors over the last 100 years are? Or are they just the same people, but they speak Swedish and use different tools?
I don't think Max Martin you couldn't really describe him as a hack. He's some kind of genius. What's a little bit different from, you know, seeing the body of his work and comparing it to the body of, like, the Beatles' work, is that you don't really see any development. You don't go from Please, Please Me
yes.
to Revolution. You don't feel the politics. You don't feel what's going on outside.
I want to end where we began with Taylor Swift, who, based on my extremely limited experience of her, is a talented,
very talented,
fine person.
Absolutely.
Max Martin is responsible newly for more than half the tracks on this latest album, 1989. So shouldn't we be a little skeptical, as I sort of was in her recent fight with Spotify and the streaming services, when she said, quote, the value of an album is based on the heart and soul of an artist who is bled into a body of work.
Yeah.
I mean, all business people here.
Yeah. I didn't really take that too seriously. I feel like there's an old Taylor and a new Taylor. There's OT and new T. And the dividing line is when Max Martin started writing songs with her, the last album, Red. And it's really almost two different singers. They both have incredible qualities, but they have very different kinds of appeal, and I think they probably have different audiences almost.
And the new Taylor in this new, as it's she has joined, gone to the dark side, one could argue, and joined up with your Swedes, is much more successful.
Exactly. And the next one who's going to join the dark side? Adele.
Is that right?
I guarantee you that Adele will have Max Martin songs on this coming album.
Huh. This is a terrific book, and I really enjoyed it.
Great. Thanks, Kurt.
John Seabrook's new book, The Song Machine, is out right now.
And now I know my heart is a ghost town. My heart is a ghost town. is a ghost town.
We the town and tell the people about the musical news coming your way.
All year long, we've been following four people who shared with us, and therefore with you and the world, their creative New Year's resolutions for 2015. In fact, one of them calls herself a New Year's resolutionary.
My name is Maria Elena Thornton, and my creative New Year's resolution was to do more reggae DJing. So I'm out here attempting to sing a little more, write some more songs, and get up on stage and perform more. I have three kids, and I live in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Reporter Lewis Wallace caught up with Maria during a busy week for her. Between work and picking up her kid at school, she was making time to record some new music.
We are leaving Yellow Springs downtown area to drive up here in the residential to the house of Portia Harris, who is a longtime friend as well as a music producer and engineer. We're working on two songs. Wait, hold on, one more time. Where did I come again?
True that, the new day begin at midnight. Early bird them rise up and greet the sunlight. 300 bird them in unison flew over my head, said, there are not 2 days, there's just one. This one day forward, so do it timely, no rewind it, come again, boom.
Most of that was good. That last line, I don't know, I might have to work on that last line.
Do you want to redo the whole thing over again?
I don't know. I mean, I honestly liked it up until the very last. I want to do something like when they go out to that part and say something like, this one a message universal T broadcast. This one is not a test. Beep. You know what I mean? Yeah. Something like that. I'm glad you guys are having a good time out there. This is what I'm supposed to do with my life, is, you know, spread joy.
What do you think interested you specifically in reggae?
Well, I think it's a combination of things, like just the music and the positivity, the rhythm, but as well as actually being raised in kind of upper middle class white, yuppie, preppy society. I went to Oakwood High School, which is one of the best public high schools in the nation, and I was surrounded by all these white kids, right? So once even just going 2 years to college, I was like, this isn't what the world looks like, you know? What's going on here? So in 1989, at age 19, I went by myself to St. Croix. I had an apartment paid for 2 weeks, and I had no job or no plan or no clue as to what I would do, but I got there and got a job on my first day and got a second job on my third day and a third job, like, in my third week. I can definitely say it's reggae music that brought me to the islands. And nothing else, really, you know, my sense of adventure, but really it was reggae music and the culture of the Caribbean.
Hey, this is Johnny Dredds. We're at Jimmy's Ladder 11 in Dayton, Ohio, and we're getting ready to gear up and play a wonderful show, opening up for Pato Banton and the Now Generation. Maria is a fireball. She's great. She's a great inspiration, and she's really quick-witted, too, as far as lyrics go. The beauty about reggae music is it's definitely about positivity and niceness. And Maria embodies that, so she's definitely going to be bringing every single piece of that to the stage.
He must me woman and me tell him Sister Irie. He ask him where me live, me tell him Yellow Springs City. But it's his little village up in the country. He must me what me do, me say that I'm a MC. The first thing him say was a friend request me. The second thing him send a private message.
We have a pretty fun ball drop at New Year's Eve here. And I mentioned it to Johnny Dredd and the Mystics if they might be interested in performing there, and that we could do a kind of a funky reggae party in the street to kind of end the year right. In fact, I would like to challenge everyone to resolute, you know, and figure out what they want to do, even just a little bit of next year, you know.
We'll follow up with Maria again before the end of the year to see whether her, you know, resolutionary fervor stays strong. Thanks to Lewis Wallace of WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio, for producing that story. Going to certain haunted houses has gotten scarier lately. Not because of clowns with chainsaws, but because of the soundtrack. Coming up, the composer who's creating the scores for the Halloween Industrial Complex. That's later this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Very soon, like it or not, every time you're out in public, you're going to hear this. And if you own a TV, there's a pretty good chance you'll get at least a glimpse of It's a Wonderful Life or Miracle on 34th Street, because maybe they're not broadcast every single day between Thanksgiving and New Year's, but kinda. Don't get me wrong, I love watching George Bailey and the Angel Clarence and Bedford Falls and Pottersville year after year, and every time I choke up at the end.
Merry Christmas, you wonderful old building alone!
I was even fine watching Macaulay Culkin slap his hands to his face and that kid get his tongue stuck to a telephone pole in A Christmas Story.
I triple dog dare you!
And it really does always warm my heart to hear and see this.
I guess I really don't know what Christmas is all about. Isn't there anyone who knows what Christmas is all about?
So, listeners, we are offering you a new creative challenge. We want you to make a 30-second film holiday themed. We're calling this latest Studio 360 contest, It's a Wonderful Short. And to judge this contest, we've got the very funny and incredibly talented actress and filmmaker Jenny Slate. You might know her for her portrayal of another animated childlike creature who asks big questions.
My name is Marcel, and I'm partially a shell, as you can see on my body, but I also have shoes and a face.
Jenny is with me now, and it makes me very happy that you're going to be doing this with us. Jenny Slate, welcome back to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited about this.
Well, excellent. So are you, in general, a big fan of the holidays that come in December?
I am. I'm a really big fan of the holidays. I'm from Massachusetts, and I don't celebrate Christmas because I'm a Jewish American woman. But I love riding around in the car and looking at all the lights. And actually, my grandfather and his father before him worked and owned in a candy factory that made almost exclusively ribbon candy, which is, you know, candy, hard candy that looks like ribbons and I mean, you can eat it, but it always kind of like made some sort of accident, like, you know, cut my tongue or something. I think it's supposed to hang off of your Christmas tree. I love all things Christmas, even though I am not very Christmassy.
So you weren't one of those Jewish American families who also celebrated Christmas?
No, we did not. My mom was really not about that. She was not like a Hanukkah bush type of lady. We did Hanukkah. We did it like really, really to the max. We decorated our house with, you know, Jewy things. And we did that. But my husband is one of the Jewish people in America whose family does celebrate Christmas just for the fun of it. So now I kind of do it with them.
Right. And I grew up being one of the not really Christian at all people who celebrate Christmas for the fun of it. So we all meet in the middle. Do you have a favorite holiday film of all of the many, many, many that have been made over the years?
Well, Home Alone is one of my favorite movies, like kind of ever. Although I've got to say, Meet Me in St. Louis, to me, is also a Christmas movie. And that is a huge one for me. It's gorgeous.
So have yourself a merry
So we're asking people to make this very short holiday film of 30 seconds or less. And in addition to being the judge, you will be their, I guess, guru and mentor. So right. Do you have any direction or advice to give the filmmakers?
If I'm the judge and you're trying to get on my good side, here are things that I like to see. Great relationships with old people who are lonely and young people, welcome them into their lives. Anything with animals, especially mice or poodles. I love anything that has an element of like a feast, you know? As a kid, I was always obsessed with Christmas hams. I fetishized those Christmas hams. I asked for Hanukkah one year for a ham to put on like the kitchen table in my dollhouse.
That's all useful. So animals, old people, feast, or be surprised, right? If somebody does something out of the left field, that'll be okay.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the weirder, the better.
Well, thanks for joining us on this little project. I think it's going to be great. And we'll see you in December after you've picked your winner.
Yes, I'm so excited to watch all of the films. And I'm really, really glad that you asked me to do this.
The deadline to submit your video to It's a Wonderful Short is midnight on Monday, December 7th, which happens to be the second night of Hanukkah. Anything goes, live action, animation, stop motion, whatever, but it's got to be 30 seconds long or less. And you can find out all the details at studio360.org.
If I should accomplish this mission, I mean, might I perhaps win my wings? I've been waiting for over 200 years now, sir, and people are beginning to talk.
Earlier in the show, we were talking about how a lot of pop songs sound kind of indistinguishable. Well, same thing goes for the not-so-slick music they play in haunted houses. Whether it's the family down the street that takes Halloween a little too seriously, or the spooked-up warehouse with billboards on the highway, they all tend to sound pretty much the same. Novelty CDs of pipe organ, screams, and wah-ha-ha. That's pretty much all there was, until now. Ike Sriskandaraja tells the tale.
Outside Chris Thomas's apartment, there are no cobwebs, scarecrows, jack-o'-lanterns, or actually any signs that might hint at what he's up to inside.
Most of the time I'm a composer for film or TV, but between the months of June and October, I'm almost exclusively a composer for haunted attractions.
Chris, by all accounts, is the first composer to write original music for haunted attractions. But before it became his job, Chris was just a new guy in town looking for something to do.
I hear they've got some fun haunted houses around here, and I've always wanted to get back into this. And little did I know the scale of what the attractions business offered here in Southern California. I had no clue what I was getting into.
The Los Angeles area turned out to be a very spook-positive place. Before long, Chris had been infected with the Haunter virus.
So every Thursday through Sunday night, I go to maybe two, at best, three haunts a night for the whole month.
One of the biggest in the area is the LA Haunted Hayride.
And I attended the show. I thought it was just unbelievable. I loved it. It was one of my favorite attractions in town. I just had one beef with it. They had this minute and 20 second long synthy loop playing over and over and over through the park. And so I thought, we need to do something about this. Now, they had a hotline that I called. And I said, hey, your attraction was so stunning, but it was undercut instantly by this terrible music. And I get this call a couple weeks later from the owner of the park saying, hey, are you the guy who called and complained about the music?
That was 4 years ago. Chris has composed the music for the hayride ever since. Each year, the producers change its theme. This season, it's a 30-minute ride through hell on a low flatbed tractor trailer, with Chris's score piped through the whole park. The music acts like an invisible choreographer setting off the scares.
And sometimes I'll arrange these big 2, 3, 4 in the music. When the boom happens, that's everyone's cue to do something, you know, really wild.
Twisted calliope music releases monsters from their cages. Shredding guitars sends demons streaking towards you. And an eerie lullaby lures spooky children who whisper into your ear. One ominous swell of strings raises large human-sized crows on stilts that bend and swoop low, flapping their wings just above your head. What was the scariest part?
Circus? I think it was the circus.
No, the freak show.
The freak show, there we go.
The clowns. They had to cover my eyes.
Everybody looking scared. They come from both sides. Then they sneak up on you and scare you on the music be going.
The music was what making me nervous.
Anytime you get a good original score, it makes it just feel all the more authentic. It brings you into it a lot more when you have a custom score like this. Like you're going through a horror movie experience.
Which is what Chris Thomas is going for. To bring the feel of horror movies into live-action haunted houses.
One of my closest mentors and my composition teacher when I first moved to L.A. was Chris Young, who did, you know, the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, Hellraiser, Drag Me to Hell. I mean, he's like the king of Hollywood horrors. And I happened to be assigned to him when I was studying film music at USC. And we ended up being a great match.
Even before Chris got his master's in horror, he seems to have always had a talent for conjuring sounds.
If you give me a mental picture, music just immediately shows up. It's always been that way. So if you paint some picture, I could find some way to spin music out of it.
How does this work exactly? My friend Jordan Kurt, who had come along for the ride, told Chris his own real-life nightmare on Elm Street.
This is a nightmare I had. You're walking down the street at night. You see a paper bag floating down, or, you know, like drifting down the road, and you pick it up and you look in it and there's a head in it.
That can be arranged.
Without missing a beat, Chris leans over his giant keyboard and begins to write a score for my friend's nightmare.
Fix a note.
Layering it.
Messed up.
Building towards a reveal.
Right there, something's going to start going wrong.
Chris digs into his archive of orchestra sounds.
Oh, I forgot I had these.
Until he finds just the right one.
This is obviously where we find the head. Cool. Getting there.
And what would a nightmare be without creepy children's voices?
I love this library. This is the Vienna Boys Choir that was sampled. It's like the real choir, but just one note at a time. It's real kids' voices. Oh, here we go. Something like that. Spooky.
Which is exactly why the haunt industry, and yes, there is such a thing, is taking notice. Last year, requests started rolling in from all over the country for original soundtracks. Chris has written 15 so far. And this year, he taught a composition seminar at the West Coast Haunters Convention in Portland. That's where he met a 14-year-old named Sam.
Sam was like, well, this will be my second or third year running my very own haunted attraction in my parents' driveway. And it's literally a full-time production. I've completely taken over the driveway all year to put this thing on. And I just thought, yes, if you want something, I will compose it just for you, like for no charge.
No trick here. He composed this score pro bono. For Chris, bringing nightmares to life is a treat.
I just absolutely love to be doing this. You know, the moment summer hits, it means it's scary music season for me. So while everyone's out hitting the beach, I haul up in this dark little room here and just set out writing scary music for 3 months. And that's the best.
For Studio 360, I'm Ike Sreeskandarajan.
If you want to go hear some of Chris Thomas's work in an actual Halloween haunted house, well, not actually haunted, but you know what I mean, we have a list of them and some examples of his music at studio360.org. And that's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. And by the way, if you like what you hear, write a review at iTunes or wherever you download podcasts. Believe it or not, it really helps. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team includes
Jenny Lawton,
Louis Mitchell,
Sean Ramosferam,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Lynn Levy,
Krista Ripple,
Emil Klein,
Elizabeth Kulas,
Caroline Lester,
Tommy Bazarian.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, take the dark lyricism of The National, add the electropop of Menomina, and you've got a punchy, terrific new indie rock supergroup. Elvi performs live next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. But I saw one of fish.